Welcome back. This is City Views. I'm Jennifer Napier Pierce. So what did Utah's early Mormon settlers eat and drink? Brocchini scoured pioneer diaries, newspapers of the day, and recipe books to find out. And today on the program, he joins us to talk about the pioneer diet and some favorite recipes. And Brocchini teaches writing and literature in Utah's public schools. He's worked at several living history museums in Utah and Colorado. He lives in Willard, Utah, where he keeps a vegetable garden and bakes bread in his wood-fired brick oven. And his new book is titled Plain But Wholesome Foodways of the Mormon Pioneers, published by University of Utah Press. Brocchini, it's great to have you. Thank you so much for the time.
It's a pleasure to be here.
And if you'd like to join our conversation, does your family have a recipe that's been passed down from generation to generation? And will you be cooking it this Thanksgiving? Give us a call. 801-355-TALK is our number. 801-355-8255. Brock, this book is full of fun facts and recipes. What got you thinking about the pioneer diet and how the early Mormon settlers gathered at the table?
Well, as you mentioned in your intro, I spent the first part of my career working in historic museums and such. And here in the West, a lot of these museums portray a sort of agricultural history. Here in Utah, of course, the Mormon pioneers were agrarians more than anything else, more than miners or industrialists. So as agrarians, food was the focus, and that's that naturally led me to look at the meals and how things were prepared beyond just the gardens and the herds and such.
Mm. Talk about the research part of this project. As I mentioned, you did a fair bit of research, and one of the interesting aspects of the Pioneer Kitchen that I wasn't aware of was the modern concept of measurements, the cup, the teaspoon. Some of the recipes that you include in here are not that specific.
Sure, and that's kind of an evolution towards our modern perspective on science. Science as we know it today really only began perhaps in the late 1800s. And before that, the common person didn't have much of a grasp about science. Instead, things were mostly passed along orally. But of course, towards the end of the 19th century, people thought, well, wouldn't it be nice if we could replicate results reliably? Mm. And so in order to get the same results every time, you got to have a formula, you got to have measurements and so on. But all that was late in coming. Our pioneers of the Brigham Young era, that was not part of their world. Everything was based on inherited traditions rather than written down formulas.
This is a recipe from 1852, a family stew of beef. Take any piece of beef good for stewing, cut it into small pieces. Again, I guess that lends to that oral tradition. You probably had seen your mother do this, and so you could visualize the poundage. But for somebody looking at this 100 years later, it's not transparent.
Exactly. One of the recipes I cooked from my family traditions last year was a pudding that was passed down, brought from England with my ancestors here to Utah. And this recipe, it calls for bowls of things. As the standard measurement was a bowl full. So a bowl of breadcrumbs, a bowl of suet, a bowl of flour, and so on. And I imagine that bowl was probably the same bowl that she used every time. So for her, it was a sort of a standard. And in a sense, they were made out in proportions, but not quite what we would imagine today.
Mm. Speaking with Brocchini, his new book is titled Plain But Wholesome, Foodways of the Mormon Pioneers, published by University of Utah Press. And if you'd like to join us, we're talking about food from pioneer days. 801-355-TALK is our number. If you've got a family recipe to share, we'd love to hear it. 801-355-8255. Let's talk about the tools of the trade. The kitchens have certainly evolved from the fire hearth of yesteryear to today's Viking stoves. But there's one tool that has stood the test of time, especially here in Utah, and that's the Dutch oven. Why is there such an affinity for the Dutch oven here in Utah?
I think it's representative. It's a symbol of sorts. Historically, just one interesting story I came across in the book. There was a young woman named Emily Barnes who was growing up in Kaysville, and she remembered when she was very young in the early 1850s that the only cooking utensil her family had was a frying pan. And other anecdotes as well about Danish pioneers who came through with nothing more than a frying pan. That was the basic get-started utensil. But then Emily recalled that as her family became more established and more prosperous, they were able to get a Dutch oven. And that step from the frying pan to the Dutch oven for her represented an increasing diversification in what her family could cook. With a frying pan, you're kind of limited. But with a Dutch oven, there were infinitely more possibilities. So for her, that transition to a Dutch oven was monumental in shaping their family's diet. Mm. So I think that that kind of became representative of our pioneer diet, the Dutch oven, that on the one hand, it gave us great freedom in cooking. On the other hand, it still required a direct connection to the fire. So the Dutch oven sits right in the fire, and that's a really organic sort of a process to cook directly with the fire rather than on a stove in which the fire is removed. And so it calls forth a certain primitive sort of element. And to me, it seems a lot like a barbecue in that, for some reason, in the modern era, the Dutch oven seems to be a male domain. Whereas historically, it would have been the female, that would have been the woman of the house that owned the Dutch oven. In fact, in the book, there's a story about Patty Sessions and how she loaned out her Dutch oven when she thought she was going to die. And then she grabbed it back as soon as it appeared that she might live. But modern day, it seems that men operate the Dutch ovens, and in a similar way to men working with barbecue grills. It seems. So I'm not sure how those symbols play out directly over the years, but it sure is a symbol of our pioneer past more than anything else.
Mm. Let's turn to the ingredients that the pioneers used. When they came to the Salt Lake Valley and other parts of Utah, they established rotating crops of corn, and wheat became a primary staple. You note in the book that the Mormons regularly used wild foods in their diets as well, and berries and fish and rabbit that were here, even the sago lily bulb.
And that seems to be something that continued up until quite recently. I remember when I was a child, the school basically went on vacation for the deer hunt, where today we call it UEA, but it's really a vestige of the deer hunt. And just about every boy I knew as a child went to the deer hunt in the 70s. Now things are kind of going away from that. But I think that this is a cultural piece that manifested until quite recently. Even still, families go out berrying up to the mountains in the summertime, or I think fishing. All of these things are somewhat present, but much more so in the pioneer day, the reliance on wild foods. And not just out of an interest in diversifying the diet, but as economic engines, that people went to the wild to hunt for ducks, for example. In my family, there's a story about my great-grandfather going out to shoot ducks to sell to the market. His older brothers were old enough to go out on their own, and they would always push my great-grandfather out because he was too young. But one year he decided, well, by gum, I'm going to go do it myself. And so as a 10-year-old boy, he went out to shoot his own ducks. And he shot 100 ducks in a day and couldn't carry them all. So he hung them on a fence and then went home to get the wagon. But it took some convincing for the great-great-grandfather to bring the wagon, not thinking that a 10-year-old boy could muster such an effort. In the end, they did go get the wagon, and they brought home this little boy's wagon load of ducks, and it represented quite a fortune for a 10-year-old boy. So these wild foods were not just for the family table. Emily Barnes, who I mentioned earlier, went out to gather hops so that she could sell the hops to the brewers in Salt Lake City, and with the money she funded a costume that she could use to court her future husband. So there's economic engines involved as well as just the family subsistence in the wild foods.
You mentioned the brewers in Salt Lake City, and that leads me to beverages that were prevalent during pioneer days. Contrary to today's Mormon religious doctrine, the pioneers made wine and beer and all hosts of beverages.
Yes, it does seem that we have moved a long ways from our beginnings. Yeah, I think when we think about the beverages, for example, you go to Checkerama or what have you, and they say that they've got more than 40 beverage selections available at the Checkerama, and we think, oh, the pioneers, they were nothing but cold water if they were lucky. But in truth, they had just as many beverage options as we do today. We tend to romanticize the past and shape it to what we want it to look like rather than looking at what actually occurred. And so when we look at the beverages, we say, oh, they must have been pious. They were righteous pioneers. But their approach to piety went in a different direction. Today we define it largely by the beverage abstinence, but historically it was not so. There was quite an array of beverages that were consumed without any feeling of guilt.
We're speaking with Brock Cheney. He has written a new book titled Plain But Wholesome: Foodways of the Mormon Pioneers. And if you'd like to join us, 801-355-TALK is our number. 801-355-8255. You write in the book that Mormon chefs used nutmeg as their go-to seasoning. What's that about? I mean, is that a derivative of the Scandinavian influence of many of the immigrants who were Mormon pioneers? Or what is it about nutmeg?
I think the Scandinavians relied more heavily on cardamom. The nutmeg seems to have been a British tradition. I'm not sure how we might have lost that, but nutmeg was much more broadly used historically than we do today. Today we consider it more of on the sweet side of things, akin to pies and such. But historically it was used with meats, it was used in sweets, it was used in all sorts of and I think possibly the reason for this could be that it was highly transportable without spoiling or you could ship it long distances and still retain its exquisite flavor. So it would be easy to carry a pound of nutmeg across the plains. A pound. Could you imagine having a pound of nutmeg? Where today it's sold in 2-ounce vials, but a pound of nutmeg could be transported quite readily and used in all sorts of things.
I have to read one of my favorite recipes, which I'm going to try. It's the dried apple pie. 3 cups dried apples, 1/2 cup honey, 1/4 teaspoon cinnamon, butter the size of a walnut. Soak apples in water overnight and cook in the same water. Add honey when apples are cooked. This makes one large pie. I love it. Did you have a favorite recipe from this book?
Oh, how could we ever say a favorite, a singular favorite? One that I've made a couple of times more recently is the molasses cake. This comes from Ruth Mosher Pack, who the Packs were the family who helped to originate the University of Utah back in the day. And this molasses cake is kind of interesting because, of course, before about 1900, the Mormons here in Utah didn't really have a good source of sugar. Sugar was exorbitantly expensive, and so instead they relied more on home-produced articles such as molasses. So they grew cane, and from the cane they squished out the juice and boiled it down to be molasses. So this molasses cake, it kind of shows the early use of sweetening in other directions. And then the other interesting thing about this molasses cake is it calls for baking soda and coffee. So in a more modern interpretation, we would use baking powder, but baking powder not being available, soda requires an acid to be activated, and so they added a cup of brewed coffee to the molasses cake to make this cake rise. And altogether, it shows some interesting food chemistry about their approaches to making something tasty and sweet but not having much to work with.
Just about 30 seconds left. You conclude the book by writing that the story of Utah's Mormon settlers is a story about food. What do you mean by that?
Oh, I've read other history books more recently in which they try to talk about the history of Utah being driven by industrialists or military interests or federal government interventions or mining interests. And it seems to me that while those things did happen and while they did have an influence, certainly they weren't the driving force. Mormon farmers have always been the driving interest in my mind in Utah's history.
Brock Cheney. He's the author of the new book, Plain But Wholesome, Foodways of the Mormon Pioneers. Brock, thanks so much and happy Thanksgiving to you.
And the same to you. It's been a pleasure.
City Views is a production of KCPW in Salt Lake City. Our technical director is Jesse Ellis. Ryan Cron composed our theme music. We're taking the next couple of days off, but we're back on Monday with a conversation with Mel Donaldson. He's an author, a filmmaker, a professor. He's coming to town to talk about writing, filmmaking, and the creative process. So hope you'll join us for that on Monday. For City Views, I'm Jennifer Napier Pierce. Thanks so much for listening, and have a safe and happy Thanksgiving.